simply going to, I am assuming that there's not a snowball's chance in hell that we're going to get on to the 30th team. So that means this is going to just have to run to the bitter end, at least eventually. So what I want to do is, in the first hour today, discuss a third analogy and then say a bit more about the metaphysics of causality, and then give this series of topics that I think are set into play by the analogies and refutation of idealism and do the refutation of idealism. Okay, and we can go back to the second analogy if you wish. I just thought we would press on and see how we go. The third analogy argues that, again, typically Kant has real problems figuring out what exactly it is he wants to argue, but the version of each statement of the thesis in A and B is a little different than each says something worth taking into account. In the A edition, it's all substances, and notice here, by the way, now that Kant's dropped event talk altogether. He's utterly clear that he's talking about substances. In England, they call medium-sized dry goods and the like. All substances, so far as they coexist, stand in thoroughgoing community, that is, mutual interaction. So the thought here is that what the notion of community means is mutual interaction, that is, mutually acting on one another, which is then the claim that all substances that exist at the same time in the universe are either directly or, we'll come to the passage where he makes it clear, indirectly, causally influencing one another. And then he, in the B edition, realizes that the statement of the A edition is totally ontological. No mention of knowledge anywhere in it, in the statement. So in the B, I need to tie this into knowledge. So there, he says, all substances, insofar as they can be perceived to coexist in space, are in thoroughgoing reciprocity. So, at least the B version makes it clear that he's interested now in the analog problem, the one I've been gesturing at all along, namely how objects that can be perceived to coexist, the condition of possibility of that is that there must be a rule
that says they are mutually determining one another. So the thought behind this comes out nicely at 8-12, where he says, and this is the contrary hypothesis. It says, now assuming that in a manifold of substances as appearances, each of them is completely isolated. So let's assume the opposite of causal interaction. That is, that no one acts on any other and receives reciprocal influences in return. And now notice that the language here tells you in part what Kant means by causal interaction. It's things are causally interacting with one another, rather whether either simultaneously or over time, only insofar as they act on one another. And you have to figure out why the language of action here, but he thinks of substances as acting on one another, and in acting on one another, influencing one another, doing things. So he uses a language and a vocabulary drawn from the language and vocabulary of agency and subjectivity. And I'll come back to that. It's part of the metaphysics of causality for Kant. Now, assuming they're completely isolated, they don't act or influence one another, I maintain that their coexistence would not be an object of a possible perception, and that the existence of one could not lead by any path of empirical synthesis to the existence of another. For if we bear in mind that they would be separated by a completely empty space, the perception which advances from one to another in time would indeed, by means of succeeding perception, determine the existence of the latter, but would not be able to distinguish whether it follows objectively upon the first or whether it is not rather coexistent with it. And that's the reductio ad absurdum. So the thought is, if I have two objects and I have empty space between them, then sure enough, I can see first A and then turn to look at B. And I can certainly be aware, he suggests, that I'm seeing first one thing and then another. But if there's nothing here that would connect them, then I would have no grounds for claiming that they exist at the same time, so that they would be coexistent. I would always have an A, then B, then A1, then B1, you know, then A2, right? It would always go like that. And I could never be assured of their coexistence. What I require, therefore, is a rule that would allow me to connect them, and the rule would have to, I would have to connect with something in the world. Can't be just a goddamn rule. A rule would have to be such that the reason we expected that A and B are existing at the same time is because they are
mutually influencing one another.
And that's precisely what he says in the following paragraph. There must, therefore, and again, remember, right, that part of the problem arises because by itself, an object cannot determine its place in time. Right? Objects do not come labeled with their temporal location. So, temporal location has to be something we achieve through the coordinating of objects through rules of perception. And of course, we cannot, secondly, remember again, as always, the premise here, as everywhere, as he says, time itself cannot be perceived. So figuring out what time something's at means getting a system of temporal relations in play. So, there must therefore, besides the mere existence of A and B, be something through which A determines for B, and also, reverse-wise, B determines for A its position in time, because only on this condition can these substances be empirically represented as coexisting. So, all right, let me finish reading this and I'll say about it. Now, only that which is the cause of another or of its determinations determines the position of another in time. Each substance, inasmuch as only in respect of its determinations can it be an effect, must therefore contain in itself the causality of certain determinations in the other substance, and at the same time, the effects of the causality of that other, that is, the substances must stand immediately in dynamical community, if their coexistence is to be known in any possible experience. So, the state of A, which is what he means by determination, right? It's one of its states, must be such that it having that state is in part determined by the influence of B, and conversely, at least in part, the state of B must be in part determined by the force and action of A. And here it's clear that Kant does have something like a force and field model in mind, in which the states of objects are vectoral. That is, if two substances, I'll diagram this. The thought is, if two substances with attractive forces, and everybody at this point in time is, you know, the background here has got to be gravitation, although the next paragraph he uses the problem of light traveling from a distant planet, right? It's going to give us the same set of issues. At any rate, if two substances with attractive forces are 3 feet apart, if A and B are 3 feet apart, lo and behold, they are. At one moment in time, then, and here's the trick, both their distance from one another, that they're 3 feet apart, and their strength of their attractive forces will determine how much closer they will move. So, and this, by the way, is why Hume got everything completely wrong. Let me explain, and I'll come back to this. The great problem of causality for you is solipsism of the present moment. That is, knowing that being in a perceptual state, Hume says, well, how do I know what's going to happen next? Right? And he has this difficulty of thinking that there's no intrinsic connection between the present, the past, and the future. Now, I want to say that both atomism and event ontology precipitate that problem. That is, the problem is as much ontological as it is epistemological. Why? Because the truth of an atomistic theory of the universe is that the state of an atom at T1, right, is complete and independent of its past and future states. That is, an atom just is, let's call it, a presence. Now, in a force field, to say that two objects are a certain distance apart is to say that their state at T1, right, is a consequence of T0 and is directed toward T2. That is, a field just is, right, that notion of the connectability between an object's past and present. So that what we typically think of a force field is to look at it at a time, because we actually think of looking at it at a time slice. We have to slice what is in fact a dynamic movement. So I want to say that intrinsically, atomistic universes are intrinsically non-dynamic, which is why, of course, they have God as who kickstarts them, sets them in motion. And even Newton thinks, keeps it in motion. If God stops, then the whole world stops, right? There's nothing about, so they have no notion of force, energy, power, any of these concepts. And I'm suggesting that it's not an accident that in solving the problem of causality, Kant thinks that the underbelly of that is a transformed metaphysics of causality, and that the crux of his book, The Metaphysical Foundations of Natural Science, is the construction of a force theory of matter. That he recognized perfectly that you could not overcome
solipsism of the present moment and have an effective conception of causality without reconceiving the nature of objects and their causal powers. So the point here is that relational properties depend on two things, namely in part on the intrinsic properties of objects, what their powers are, and on the context they find themselves in. So an object in this state, right, will depend upon, will be in this state because of its intrinsic properties and its relationship, right, to surrounding objects. And those surrounding objects, of course, will equally be, so that every object, by this way, is going to be connected, so that its properties and determinations will be mutually affected. Now, that also explains what an event ontology, I'll come back to, cannot allow, why it must be mutual. Namely, that if the as the second substance is a condition for change in the first substance, so the first substance is not in fact capable of changing itself without a causal contribution from another substance. In other words, if they lack mutuality, then you would have a state of affairs whereby the state of a substance would be determined by itself alone, its actions, and not by anything it received. And that would, in a sense, rip it out of its causal context. So we get, in the next paragraph, a kind of fulfillment of this, a passage that's received, for reasons we'll come back to, a lot of interpretation. He says the word community is in the German language ambiguous. It may mean either communio or commercium. We here employ it in the latter sense as signifying a dynamical community, without which even local community could never be empirically known. We may easily recognize from our experiences that only the continuous influences in all parts of space can lead our senses from one object to another. The light which plays between our eye and the celestial body produces a mediate community between us and them, and thereby shows us they coexist. Does anyone find anything strange in that passage for a Kantian?
It seems to imply a realist perspective on the relationship between me and the celestial bodies.
Sure does. At least this, that I can only have a perceptual awareness of those celestial bodies if and only if
my body is in the same space as those bodies, and that therefore my perceptual accounting of them is in part determined by my empirical spatial location, and that empirical spatial location being one which provides, therefore, a necessary empirical condition for perception of coexistence. So suddenly, rather surprisingly, it turns out that I can only be aware of two objects coexisting that are spatially separated from one another if I am in the same space as they are in, and then a whole series of further conditions, namely that space is regular, that I'm at a certain distance, operates. So it turns out that there are causal conditions of perception. Causal conditions that mean that only a certain type of spatially embodied perceivers can have perceptions of alteration and simultaneity. And I will come back to this, but this is one of those little fleeting passages that Kant, after he finished the Particular Reason in his notebooks, began to think harder about, that is to acknowledge the role of embodiment in our perceptual activities. Okay. Give or take, that's the argument of the third analogy. And I've been suggesting, therefore, now I just want to talk for the next 20, 25, 30 minutes about the metaphysics of causality, that this precipitates a certain set of metaphysical commitments. As I suggested last week, the two additions, first is we're going to displace event ontology with substance ontology. And secondly, we're going to say a substance can cause a change of determinant state of another substance only insofar as it contains the ground that determines the successive states of the other substance. Remembering that logically, cause and effect points back to ground and consequence. So the notion of ground and consequence, I'm now suggesting, which has a purely logical meaning, obviously, but Kant wants to give that a metaphysical reading. That is, he wants to argue that in order for causality to occur, then something must be the ground of the successive states of the other object. In the case of mutual interaction, the grounds or powers of the substances will jointly determine one another's states in such a way that these states can be understood as simultaneous. Be patient. Well, what do we mean by ground? What's distinctive about grounds? So a ground determines the state of another substance not through a determinate state of its own, or indeed even its mere existence, but through. Both of those statements would hold essentially for event ontologies, right? They would say what determines the state of affairs is a previous determinate state of affairs, or the existence of a previous determinate state of affairs. So I'm going to have to argue that rather a ground determines the state of another substance through an indeterminate, I want to be clear here, let me be clearer, through a temporally indeterminate activity that is incapable of ever becoming determinate itself. Why am I saying such nasty things? Well, the thought here there's what I'm looking at, it was just a visual demonstration. Is that the activity of the liquid on the back of my throat through a series of, and Kant's going to say, by the way, an infinite continuous series of changes the state of the back of my throat from dry to quenched. Now the point here is the water is not an event. The water is a substance, and its activity, right, whatever those powers are, they're working the whole time, you know, affecting the back of my throat and changing its state. But that power that allows the water to do that is not itself changing, right? So you say, well, what's the temporal location of the power? And that's what's indeterminate, I'm saying. That in order to imagine a power acting on an object, that power itself cannot be another determinate state, because then there would have to be something determining it. And this, of course, is the fancy of event ontologies, namely, complete determinacy all the way down. But I'm suggesting that Kant, before Derrida, before Heidegger, before Wittgenstein, understood that determinacy is always the effect. What I mean, both, because being in a determinate state and therefore being temporally determinate is always the effect of a continual action, right, of a temporally indeterminate power. And the power is indeterminate not just temporally, but also as a state, because what do we know of a substance? We know its powers, but how do we know its powers?
through what they determine. That is, all the determinacy we're going to get here is through the effects of the action. Now, and about that, in a way, Locke was right in a certain way. That when Locke said, even if we had microscopic eyes, right, so we could see, when we saw water, we could see the H2O. And when we saw my throat, oof, I don't even want to think what's there. And we could see them interacting, we still see things interacting, but that wouldn't give us the connection. Right? The connection is still going to be understood by a rule that is, at a certain level, simply inductive. So, the thought here then is that several of the most fundamental properties of bodies, like filling a determinate space and communicating motion, are to be explained in terms of the exercise, finally for Kant, of attractive and repulsive forces. I won't go through this. People used to care about this stuff. Schelling's longest critique of Kant is on whether or not we need repulsive forces, why there must be two forces rather than one. And this was a huge debate in the philosophies of nature at the turn of the century, 18th century. But at any rate, this was a fundamental part of Kant's theory. And further, that he thought that if we could understand that ultimately attractive and repulsive forces are, so to speak, the ultimate constituents of the universe, they're your prime matter, so to speak, and since they are themselves not further conditioned, some of the arguments in the foundation of natural science show how you can generate the minimum necessary conditions for a material world just using attractive and repulsive forces, which is, say, a Newtonian world is mechanics is matter in motion, so what you have to give an account of is how there can be laws of motion, and then Newton's three laws of motion have to be accounted for, and that's what Kant tries to do there. If he can do that, showing just attractive and repulsive forces will do it, then he can show that there are unchanging grounds upon which all motions of objects depend, and if the grounds are unchanging, which is to say, if the conditions which would lead them to change are never present, or the conditions that keep them in place are always present, if that's the case, then it makes those laws necessary laws, unchanging. So that the possibility of strong causal laws, in a sense, will depend on these unchanging grounds. Complicated, so I'm not going to go into Kant's theory of law. It's really complicated. So, for Hume, I'm suggesting now, we explain the world in terms of completely discrete, instantaneous mental snapshots. And that's the problem. And that both is his epistemology, and now I'm suggesting to you
that his epistemology stands in a one-to-one relationship with his ontology.
And you could, if you were so minded, retell the history of early modern philosophy from Descartes to Kant strictly through their theories of matter. And in each case, their theories of matter precipitate their other epistemological and rational commitments. Which way it goes, whether epistemology is a term in ontology or ontology epistemology, I'm not saying, but it's interesting and important for us, again, because empiricism gets such a heavy hearing, to remind ourselves that once upon a time philosophers cared about such things. Right? And it's because epistemology almost by definition is empiricist. It makes us ontologically stupid. And Kant's struggling to break out of, I think, that stupidity. I think that's part of what the Praetorian Term is all about. It's also just momentarily. So a cause is required to bring about a succession of states in a substance as its effects, and a cause, therefore, need not be an event. It need not be prior to its effect, and it need not have any specific characteristics at all. Event models trivially can make absolutely no sense of simultaneity. Right? It's just a contradiction in terms. And it was for that reason that Schopenhauer banished mutual interaction from the world. Passage quoted on page 238 of Watkins. Only insofar as a state A precedes a state B in time, but their succession is necessary, not contingent, only to that extent is state A the cause and state B the effect. The concept of mutual interaction contends, however, that both are the cause and both the effect of the other. But this means that the same as that each one is both earlier and a later event. Right? If you think of events as instantaneous, then if A is the cause of B and B is the cause of A, because we're talking about mutual interaction, then B is prior to A and A is prior to B and vice versa. And you can see why just Schopenhauer thinks, well, that's got to be absurd, which is what he says, which is absurd. Ungedanke, unthinkable. For that, both states are simultaneous, and necessarily so, cannot be accepted, because in necessarily correlated and simultaneous, they constitute only one state. That's event ontology. It literally finds mutual interaction unintelligible. Which is why all those Kantians who look at the second analogy and not the third miss the depth of Kant's analysis. Right? You cannot, I've been suggesting all along, you need all three analogies, but it's the theory that really has the ontological bite, because it shows the depth of his departure from event ontology. So once you have all this in place, then a variety of other things follow. I won't go through all the complications, but Kant solves the problem that you do not need temporal precedence to have causal precedence, which, and the example they always give is the cannonball on the pillow. if it's sitting there, what causes the dent? Is it, you know, the welcoming arms on the pillow? Or, oh, I'm going to go in just to get that cannibal in there? Or vice versa. Because what you need is ground and effect. You don't have to say, you don't have to, they can be simultaneous. Cause and effect, in other words, this is a problem in metaphysics of causality. How can an effect be simultaneous with its cause? Well, it's the answer is if it's the ground. So grounds are what endure through change of the states they cause, whereas events are ephemeral. Grounds determine states and therefore are responsible for the kind of necessity between it and its effects. That is, I'm saying, again, whatever necessity means here, it means something like natural necessity. It's simply, this is what water does to a dry throat. It has those powers, right, that do that. And they are thus, because that's what it is to have a power, and that's the circularity part, because they're not distinct from their effects in the way events must be. We know a power, so the what is counts as a vicious circularity in the traditional metaphysics of causality. I guess I was going to Keith earlier. Philosophers take the Moliere line, opium has a dormative power. What's a dormative power? Oh, it makes you sleep. And the problem is, if you're an empiricist, that's circular. Right? Because your only definition of the power, right, is its effect. So therefore, the notion of power drops out. I'm suggesting once we have an appropriate metaphysic of substance, ground, and effect, and understand that we know the powers of a substance through its actions, then hopefully that circularity does not seem vicious. Nonetheless, you might say, ha, what on earth is it that you mean by power? And the indication, and why do we think that substances act and influence things? Well, I think Kant's language here should tell us that he is in fact basing his understanding of causality on his understanding of human agency. So when you, these are passages, so that the power of the I thing is to bring about, and it's a power we're aware of, so these are all those passages which I'm going to read out after the break, but all those passages where he says we are aware of the spontaneity of the I thing. Kant is saying that we are aware of our own synthetic activity. The thought here is that actively producing, say drawing a line, becomes a model and an analog for understanding the motion of objects.
Hence, when he says, even time itself we cannot represent, save insofar as we attend in the drawing of a straight line, merely to the act of synthesis of the manifold, whereby we successively determine inner sense, and so doing attend the succession of this inner determination. So we have a pre-theoretical awareness of action. In fact, it's something the baby develops. Child developmental work on this is very interesting because babies actually, in fact, Alice Query was saying that Lena's at that moment where she discovered a new causal law today, namely you scream and you get something. And she tested it out apparently all morning long, you know, if anyone else would walk away and Lena would go, ah! And someone would come running and she'd smile and they walk, right? So she's got the idea of action at a distance, and there'll become a time when she has to figure out those things she's really affecting and those things she only thinks she's affecting in her life. But the point is that that discovery is the discovery of our powers to change and alter the world so that we have a very good idea that doing something makes a change in the world, and therefore something else can do it, right? An explosion shoots my hand up, and it will lift up too. And we think that my action is analogous to the action of, say, the explosion or the water bursting through the drain or whatever it is that is lifting the object. So we model that notion of power. And that notion of having, of so that objects act. And therefore, our anthropomorphically stupid way of talking is not so stupid when we say, the door gave me a bruise. Well, it's true that unless I had bumped into the door, I would have not got bruised, but it was the causal powers of the door. It had a sharp corner, and it had that much resistance that caused the bruise. So it did act, and something with different materials or differently shaped would not have produced that. Objects act. Yeah?
Can you push it further to say that it's like Kant is giving a defense of a mythical worldview? I mean, it seems like, more rational, the gods of the Greeks or the pre-philosophic were more rational than the philosophers.
Well, certainly more rational than the empiricists. I certainly agree with that. I think that there is a problem. The disenchantment of the world often actually rids the world by thinking that anything that's like, based on a human projection must be illusory, actually ends up ripping out of the world its own most characteristic powers. That's the thought. So it certainly is an argument that science should not be interpreted as a process of disenchantment, which it has been. And that's certainly right. So that, and that will go all the way down to our understanding of explanation, right? Explanation ultimately, it will be a story about bringing certain things about. So the model of explanation is not just nomological deduction, as pretty as that is. As everyone knows, a pure mathematical law, if you cannot model it sufficiently, then you cannot give an account of what it's supposed to do, or generate experiments, or the like. And modeling is, in fact, the activity of showing the connection between the theory and the structure of the actual physical structure of the world, sufficient for experimentation, that is, to produce certain effects. That's what experiments do, bring things about. So causality is a bringing things about. So alteration, then, in the world is going to be a second problem that Kant solves. Event ontology, events are instantaneous. If you have a notion of substance, then what you have is the idea that alteration is a continuous change through an infinite number of degrees to bring about an effect, not something that's instantaneous. And then, of course, that allows you to ideally do more science, because then you can try to be detailed about the bringing about of the effects. Once you begin to think that, then you can say, well, how does water do things? And then you can ask about chemical reactions between the water and, you know, the back of the throat and the like. It is the structure of causal laws, their asymmetry, that explains the causal relationship. A ground determines a consequence. That's the crux. It's the asymmetry, not the temporal order. That's how Kant's asymmetry replaces temporal order. And a consequence, so a ground, and I want to be clear about how it works out here. A ground determines a consequence. That is, when we talk about water having the power to, so in thinking about the ground of my throat being quenched, we're talking about the water doing it. Conversely, a consequence simply entails the existence of some ground, but no particular ground. And that will preserve that asymmetry, definitely. Finally, a power, interestingly enough, and this is, there's a huge metaphysical literature on this. A power is neither a substance nor an accident. Roughly because we use powers to explain what accidents a substance has, and therefore if we identified it with the accident, there'd be no explanation, while if we identified it with the substance, there would be only properties and nothing having those properties. So it turns out that, and this does cause all sorts of problems, that it does commit us to an indeterminate conception of substance. So powers are necessarily indeterminate. They are known through their effects. I think that's all I want to say about the metaphysics of power.
Now, I don't suspect when you started reading Kant, you thought it was going to go there. But at least here, I mean, here is at least my challenge. The first bit of the challenge is easy. I think all of this is necessary in order to make sense of the three analogies. Without this sort of metaphysics, I think the three analogies are just not going to model anything coherent. But my second claim, which is my segue into the second half of the class, is I take deeply, deeply seriously that Kant is a transcendental idealist, and he says transcendental idealism entails empirical realism. And now I think he really means realism. I don't think he's any kind of phenomenalist. I think he really thinks what he's talking about is thick, heavyweight realism at the empirical level. And he thinks you only get that kind of realism, the kind of realism that gives you substances and powers and all the like, and the refutation of idealism, I'm going to suggest in a second, if you have transcendental idealism. So only the idealist, which is how Kant started, only the idealist can be a realist. Okay, let's have a break. Come back.